From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
Get this, Donald. Nasty women are tough. Nasty women are smart. And nasty women vote.
The latest October surprise will hit millions of Americans in their pocketbooks and wallets. Insurance premiums on Obamacare exchanges will rise an average of 25% on the federal exchange next year.
I plan on serving out my terms here in the state of Connecticut and look forward to the challenges. I like my job.
We like our jobs here, too, on The Wheelhouse, where you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Mark Pazniokas. He's Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Paz.
Hello, good morning.
And Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello once again, Susan.
Good morning.
And we're going to start by talking about the Connecticut Republican Party. And there's a lot of variety of stories, I suppose, to tell. The first one maybe we can start with, let's start at the national level and sort of work our way down. You know, Paz, this is something that we always seem to talk about when we have a year in which there could be contested congressional races, but we see the Republicans in the state not really putting up much of a fight. I don't know. I guess we've become somewhat used to this, but is this year worse or weirder than ever before? They're not raising any money. I don't know that there's any real challenge being put up here in these five congressional races.
For the first time since the House seats flipped parties, because you remember back in the dim days of 2006, before that election, Republicans actually held three of the five U.S. House seats. So we went from that to, you know, being seen as this, you know, immutably blue state. But in any event, since those seats flipped, there has never been a challenger, a Republican challenger in the 4th District down in Fairfield County or the 5th out in western Connecticut that's raised less than $1.3 million, and some have raised two. This year, not so much. About 100, as of the end of the third quarter, it was $122,000 was raised by John Chabon down in the 4th, and Clay Cope in the 5th hadn't quite cracked $100,000. And in the U.S. Senate, our friend Dan Carter, the Republican who's up against Blumenthal, his available cash that he reported was at $35,000. Now, his campaign treasurer told me the other day there was actually a mistake in that. It was probably closer to $60,000. But that's $60,000 in available cash up against something north of $4 million for Dick Blumenthal.
To run a Senate race. And again, we set the bar in the Linda McMahon days of yore somewhat higher.
Somewhat higher. It is – we do get money shock. We had two open races – $50 million a crack, and then we go from that to Dan Carter, who, if he's lucky, he's going to raise in total $300,000. Which, by the way, you take out the self-funders. Somebody pointed out to me the other day that that's going to be the most money a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate has raised since Lowell Weicker's last race.
Well, so the Republicans in this respect, at the statewide level, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't, right? Everybody complains, including me, when they have these self-funding, rich Fairfield County kinds of candidates like Tom Foley and Linda McMahon. When they don't have those kinds of self-funding candidates, they can't raise any money. And I think it's not for just one reason. I mean, obviously, people often see candidacies, for better or worse, as investments, and they don't like to invest their money in things that will not bear fruit. So, I mean, that creates kind of a feedback loop in lots of places, and incumbents are very hard to turn out of office, generally speaking. But also, look, the numbers are all wrong. You know, there are 700,000-something Democrats and 400,000-something Republicans, so the numbers stink. And, you know, I have to say the leadership and bench and all that stuff, it's just not what it could be.
Well, but when you talk about that investment, Colin, I guess I just wonder if there's some thought at all about making investments in a party that aren't just for one cycle. I mean, to build a bench, to build a party system, to actually maybe try to get more people to register as Republicans, for goodness sakes, that takes a little bit of time. But is anybody thinking about that?
That would be nice. I mean, if they did that. I mean, in some ways, the Republican Party in Connecticut ought to be better than the Republicans at the national level at creating the so-called big tent. You know, I mean, their policies and their attitudes, I mean, the sort of Republican ethos in Connecticut is not as exclusive or punitive or unwelcoming as it is in other parts of the country. So they should be able to recruit new constituencies. And, of course, also Connecticut is a very fertile ground in the sense that there are 800,000 unaffiliated voters, more unaffiliated voters than there are any other kind of voters. So you should be able to do it, but it takes probably a plan. Building talent. It takes recruiting talent from non-traditional Republican areas. The party has not seemed terribly interested in that, except when they have to send a sacrificial lamb out to run against Rosa DeLauro or something. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a little bit of a mystery. I mean, they shouldn't be this bad. They should be a little better. And, you know, I mean, I don't – it seems to me that the 5th District could have been a competitive race somehow this year. A lot of these races probably won't be if, in fact, there's an incredibly depressed Republican turnout because of Trump. But if that were not the case, I would have thought maybe the 5th, you know, would have a little juice in it.
I think it's partly a cycle thing. Back in the 90s, during the Senate races in the 90s were just blowouts for the incumbent Democrats. That lasted up until about 2004 when Chris Dodd ran his last race. So partly it's a cycle thing. It's like the 2nd District. The 2nd District is blowouts for Democrats until suddenly it's not. And that cycle is continuing. Right now we're seeing a ton of blowouts for Joe Courtney and very, very, very weak candidates. But every once in a while things flip and things turn. So that's part of it.
I will say, Paz, that when driving around last weekend in the far eastern part of the state, because I live in the northwest corner, I don't get up to the quiet corner all that often. I saw more than a couple houses that had this interesting array of yard signs. They were Donald Trump and Joe Courtney yard signs. Stranger things, I suppose, have happened, but I guess that's maybe a little bit of the mix up there.
The DNA out that part of the state is interesting. That's where Ross Perot did his best in Connecticut. So people out there can get kind of persnickety about their politics.
Connecticut's Republican Party Chair Jerry Romano is accusing a Democratic state Senate candidate of violating clean election laws by likening his Republican opponent to Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. Tim Bowles, whose campaign is being run by the Vinci Group, ran a photo of Republican opponent Heather Summers next to Trump under a headline that reads, quote, "Con artists we can't afford." The mailer also includes an editorial page headline from the Day newspaper that reads, "Summers flunks the Trump test." Explain this to me, Colin, a little bit here. So essentially putting the candidate who's at the top of the Republican ticket next to a state Senate candidate is somehow unconstitutional, illegal, breaking the rules?
Okay, the way I understand it, and I'd be very comfortable being corrected by anybody else on this panel, but this all stems from an elections enforcement ruling. And what the ruling says is that if you're participating in our citizens' election program, that's the one where you get a public grant as opposed to having to raise private monies, you can only spend that grant on your own campaign. You can't spend that grant on anybody else's campaign, and that the elections enforcement ruling says having a visible other candidate on your campaign materials amounts to an expenditure either on behalf of that candidate or that candidate's opponent, depending on how you're using it. And this did come up in a previous cycle. It actually came up on the other side where Republican candidates were running pictures of Malloy, using him in the same scary way that Trump is being used on this mailer. So there's some precedent for it. Everybody, therefore, probably should have known about it. I didn't actually remember it, but that I'm not running for office right now.
Yeah, I mean, the theory behind it is if you're going to be advocating for a candidate, you have to account for the money. So it's not just that this was a hit on Heather Summers. You could also argue this is a hit against Donald Trump, and therefore you need to account for it as you're helping Hillary Clinton. So you have that piece. So you have a conflict with state and federal campaign rules and how you account for that. This stuff, the accounting gets very complicated. But yes, the other aspect is under the voluntary public financing system, the rules are even tighter. Now, the SEC was late in the 2014 cycle that they said, you know, this isn't kosher what a lot of the Republicans did. That is still pending. This time, the rules of the road seem pretty clear. You can do this kind of thing, by the way, with other sources of of money, and the Democratic State Central Committee certainly has done that in a few other places, and they had the right accounting, the right mix of federal and state. It's called compliant funds. Like I said, it get you know the accountants love this stuff.
Probably much more than we do.
I have a question for Susan.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also wonder how good a tactic this is anyway. In other words, you're trying to beat Heather Bond Summers down there in Groton. And I wonder whether tying her to Trump is even a particularly worthwhile tactic.
I don't think it's actually a bad idea. You know, I don't think it's bad for her because, like we've said, there are a lot of Trump supporters out in eastern Connecticut. And really, I don't know if that's even going to stick. People know who Heather Summers is.
She's bailed on him, by the way, on Trump.
Yeah. So I think
and
it's
these elections,
overreach.
They usually turn out to be about like band shells that you know.
Right.
I mean, some public park, right?
I mean, it's going to be about Heather Summers and what she did in Groton and whether or not they like her and how they feel about what's going on in Hartford. People tend to make distinctions between what's going on at the presidential level and what's happening at the state level.
But I think the other piece of this, though, is Joe Romano, who heads up the Republican Party, is in this sort of weird position, right, where, as we've said, Paz, he's running a party that probably looks a lot different in Connecticut than it looks across the rest of the country. He is staunchly supporting, including in a forum that I hosted not too long ago at Central Connecticut State University, supporting Donald Trump as the candidate at the top of the ticket. But in this way, even if it is a legal distinction that he's making here, trying to distance one of his key candidates in the entire state from the top of the ticket.
Yeah, he's not really distancing Summers from Trump as much as he's trying to say the Democrats play fast and loose with campaign finance rules. And that's, you know, that's a meme he's hit at before. And, you know, there's some justification for that. The Democrats have had kind of a rocky time the last 2 years in dealing with the State Elections Enforcement Commission over how they raised and spent money in 2014.
I mean, he's not wrong about this, although it does a little have the ring of Charles Manson saying, why don't you cops do something about the Zodiac Killer? It's like he knows this is illegal because he did it.
I have to ask you, I mean, one of the reasons that this is an important race is because, you know, there's a chance, maybe it's an outside chance, but there's a chance that the Republican Party in the state, despite the non-coattail having effect of Donald Trump in Connecticut, they might actually be able to take back the state Senate.
Yes. So the Republicans need 4 seats to flip to take the state Senate back. And one of the races that's definitely targeted, and this is Andrew Maynard's old seat, is the race that Heather Summers is running in down in southeastern Connecticut. The question is, where do these other 3 seats come from? If they can win that one and they can win the race in Middletown, if Dante Bartolomeo loses and Lanzuzio wins there, that's another one. Those are probably the 2, I hate to say easiest because they're not easy. Those are the 2 easiest ones to flip. But then where do you get the other 2 seats? So is Joe Crisco vulnerable? Is May Flexer vulnerable? Is Kathy Ostin vulnerable? And it's a very outside chance. And they are not helped by the fact that Republican voters may be so depressed by the time Election Day rolls around that they stay home. People will split their ticket otherwise. I think that that's absolutely possible. But I think the real danger is that people just get Trump fatigue and they're so depressed and they know Hillary Clinton's going to win that they stay home.
Yeah, I don't know, Paz. I mean, Trump fatigue or not, if there is a chance for the Republican Party to pick up one of the chambers of the legislature, if indeed the party feels as though it's important to have a check on Governor Malloy and everything else Democratic in the state, wouldn't it seem as though that's a push worth making to get voters out and try to make that change?
Sure. I mean, a couple of thoughts. I mean, one is that, truth be told, the Senate Republican leaders are both thrilled at what the playing field looks like and quietly terrified that they might actually win a majority and have to cobble together a budget next year. You know, let's be absolutely honest about that. They really would like to win in 2018. You know, clean house on the budget in the next 2 years and then come in. That being said, the terrain does favor the Republicans. If you look at the potential for flipping seats, but they would have to sort of hit it perfectly. They would have to hit in every vulnerable district. And, you know, you try to handicap all the cross currents in this race, you know, just what we've kicked around in the first 5 minutes or so, it's very difficult. You know, down in Meriden, you have Dante Bartolomeo, the Democrat, who is facing Len Susio for the third time. You know, is Susio going to win on the third time? You know, I don't know. I mean, he's working it. And Joe Crisco down in the, you know, New Haven suburbs of, you know, Hampden and Woodbridge. Joe Crisco's 80 years old. Sometimes you can pick somebody off because they stay one race too long. You know, that was a factor in 2006 when Chris Murphy snuck up on Nancy Johnson. So, you know, there are those kinds of things. So you have national trends and you have sort of the organic factors in all these districts, and it all mixes together.
So, yeah, these things are hard to handicap for all of the reasons that Susan and Paz have said. And so there's kind of maybe two or three different ways of looking at them. I mean, one operational theory would be that, yeah, there won't be a tide for Republicans because at the top of the ticket, there's this, you know, very problematic candidate. And then elsewhere near the top of the ticket, there are weak congressional candidates. There's nothing in place to create some kind of tide that would lift smaller boats. So that's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is, as has been suggested, there's tremendous amount of discontent about how the state runs and operates right now. There is a desire for a change in leadership policy strategy. That obviously helps any kind of challenger candidate and probably minority party candidates. But you have to keep coming back to the fact that these races are usually fetishistically local. You know, like the Flexer race that that Susan mentioned, that does involve some kind of freaking band shell that either did or didn't get state funding or something in some park somewhere in Windham or something. I mean, it's stuff like that. And in a weird way, too, it's often the obverse of the way the national campaign is argued out. Usually national candidates are talking about cutting waste and pork in state government. Usually if you're running for state rep, you're kind of offering to deliver some pork, right? I'm going to get that band shell built. You know, you usually have to say to your constituents, I'll bring a little stuff in here to Killingly. I'm going to take care of you people. So, I mean, the rhetoric is actually kind of different from what you see at the national level.
Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Mark Pazniokas from CTMirror.org. Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about money in politics, a fascinating story that Paz has out today. We'll also talk about what legal pot in Massachusetts might mean here in Connecticut. That's next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the news of the week. Today with Mark Pazniokas from CTMirror.org, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show. What's on today's show, Colin?
Well, we're going to build on some of the reporting that Paz is about to describe. We're going to do a show about gangsters. And in particular, Deirdre Baer, one of the great biography writers of our lifetime, has written a comprehensive biography of Al Capone. We'll talk about that. Also, we'll talk to a former member of the Gambino family, who I think is running in Middlefield now or something. No, I'm kidding. If you're running in Middlefield, I didn't mean that. I just grabbed a town out of my town.
Here come the emails. That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. So this morning, Paz, we wake up and read in the CTMirror.org a story that you've written about an interesting little legal loophole that allowed for just a moment, just a brief moment, the Republican Party in the state to be flush with cash and then not so much anymore. What happened exactly?
Well, it looks a lot like money laundering. But let me quickly say it's completely legal. On one glorious day last month, September 30th, the last day of the financial quarter, about $877,000 arrived in the Connecticut Republicans' bank account.
Woohoo!
223 contributions, but it came in one slug of electronic transfer. And, you know, there's some pretty well-known people like Sheldon Adelson, every Republican's favorite independent expenditure guy out in Las Vegas. He and his wife, they were each had the maximum of $10,000. You know, James Dolan for the, you know, Cablevision, the Knicks and the Rangers, you know, he had his $10,000. But minutes later, the money flowed immediately to the Republican National Committee. So what happened was there is something called joint fundraising committees. And, you know, there's been a lot of national press about it. Hillary started one early and everybody said that was presumptuous. She didn't even have the nomination. Donald Trump started one. And what they are is they are very legal scams to get around fundraising limits.
Legal scams. I like the distinction.
Well, yeah, I know. And I really did struggle with the words there. Circumvent was the word we used a lot.
Yeah.
But the way it works, there is a limit. John, I know you're dying to give money to the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee. You can only give $33,400.
No, I'm not.
You can only give $33,400 to them. And we all know what a bummer that is. But with these joint fundraising committees, you can effectively raise that limit to $400,000, to $500,000. I won't get way down in the weeds, but the way you raise the limit that high is you take a whole bunch of disparate committees and you bundle them together in one joint fundraising committee. So every committee, they have a limit on what you can give to them. If you can give $10,000 to the Connecticut Republicans, you can give $10,000 to the Connecticut Democrats and every other state party. So if you get all the state party committees to join the joint fundraising committee, you can do 10,000 times however many you have. So you get, in the case of the Trump one, you get 21 state committees. That's 210,000. You throw in there's a type of national committee that can actually accept 100,000. You throw them in, you're up to 300. Anyway, that's how it works. And so the Connecticut Republicans, again, and this is not to pick on Republicans.
Yeah.
Trust me, folks, Hillary Clinton has done this bigger and better than Donald Trump even has thought about doing. Her victory committee, they call it, her joint fundraising committee has raised $400 million. Trump's is, down around 87.
Boy, campaign finance laws are both boring and terrifying at the same time. It's amazing. And it's obnoxious the way that they just don't function at all anymore. That there's whenever someone tries to put like a little roadblock in place, the money always flows around it somewhere. There's all these little rules that people can use to get around it. There's no real limits anymore. And it's becoming increasingly a problem that people don't ever seem to care.
Well, yeah. So Thomas Jefferson had a dream that, with a standard public school education, the average American would be able to understand how he is getting screwed. But now you really need like an MBA to understand how you are getting screwed, or at least how your political process is getting hijacked. There's some kind of complicated subtext, which I, A, haven't thought about enough, and B, probably wouldn't understand if I did think about it enough. But there's a subtext to this. These victory committees have been kind of interesting and problematic in various ways, particularly in terms of their level of allegiance to Trump. And there have been some states where, as Trump's star began to falter, they began stripping his name out of their literature and stuff like that. But because, in fact, what we know is that the RNC has provided a lot of the skeletal framework for political operations in a lot of states where Trump doesn't have one. So I think a lot of this money that's probably going to the RNC right now in terms of in the form of transfers from the Trump Victory Committee – it may, in fact, be used to help state candidates, professional candidates.
That's a good point. What the RNC ultimately does with the money, it may go more to down ballot stuff than Trump. They had their own agreement, and there was also a second joint fundraising committee. One, it's more about Trump. This one, you can spread the money around more. But so that stuff also gets very complicated. But this is something that your Supreme Court has encouraged to happen. There used to be an aggregate limit on what one guy can give spread around the country. It was about $120,000. The Supreme Court a couple years ago blew that up. It was the same 5-4 majority that gave us Citizens United. And the Supreme Court was warned.
Yeah, there's a great moment in Paz's story where Alito says, "Well, I don't think they would do that," describing exactly the thing that passes door. It's sort of like, really? Rob the bank? I don't think people would rob a bank, right? People don't rob banks.
Well, and the lawyer, one of the lawyers, I was able to reach one of the lawyers who actually argued in that case, and he could just tell how pissed off he is. And he just said, and he was talking about Chief Justice Roberts. He said, "Chief Justice Roberts was wrong. I was right."
The lawyer is confusingly named Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
We just have a couple minutes before you have to take a break. Something that has had a lot of money flowing into it is this ballot question in Massachusetts, Susan, whether or not that state is going to get legal pot. Now, It's on the ballot in Massachusetts. It's on the ballot up in Maine. It's something that's very interesting in Massachusetts because they've placed a very low excise tax on it. Essentially, it's going to be much, much lower a tax than it is in some of the Western states that have already legalized, meaning potentially Massachusetts might not see the revenue generation from legal pot that some have projected. But at the same time, they may be undercutting the price of the black market. Real question for us here is, what do you think it means to Connecticut? Are we going to start talking very seriously about this at the legislative level if indeed Massachusetts decides to legalize?
Well, one thing they could do is they could just put up the tolls on the border now to catch everybody heading north to Longmeadow, where all the weed shops are going to be, I'm sure. Enfield's going to have a great contact high. This actually does pose a lot of different legal questions. Like, well, if you buy weed in Massachusetts and you bring it back to Connecticut, what does that mean? If you have more than whatever the amount that's been decriminalized is, if you have more than that and you bought it in Massachusetts legally, well, can they prosecute you? Are they going to do that? What's the legal stuff here? So it might just be simpler. The legislature might decide, you know, it's just simpler to just – let's just legalize this.
I will say something that's happened in some of the Western states, Colin, is cartels have set up shop in Colorado. It's a really good market. It's a good place to ship out of because you can grow it legally and then ship it elsewhere. We just have about 30 seconds.
Somebody in the New York Times called it a massive public health experiment on the population. There's, for example, no laws about what the legal limit is for driving while impaired through marijuana. It's like because it's been illegal so long, we don't know how to treat it as a legal drug. All the stuff that's in there, you know, that you would need to have in there just doesn't exist.
I just see a day when Colin won't be trying to entice NPR donors with L.L. Bean wreaths anymore.
Brownies.
That's all I'm going to say.
It's all about – well, I'll tell you what. We are going to try to entice people with maybe L.L. Bean wreaths. That's coming up right now. If you'd like to support The Wheelhouse and the other shows that you hear on WNPR, here are some friends to tell you how you can do just that. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're joined today by Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pasniokas, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, which you can see at ctmirror.org, and Colin McEnroe, who's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. I'll tell you that on my program next, it's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, we'll be talking about the huge influx of Syrian refugees coming to New England in just the last several months over the course of the last year. We'll also sit down with NPR's Bill Littlefield, a longtime host of Only a Game at WBUR, to talk about the sporting culture of New England. A little bit of Sox talk tomorrow, Paz. You'll like that. Coming up on next. I want to move to a story that is fascinating and sort of loops back on some of the conversations we've had over the course of the last couple of years about the way the state invests in transportation and the role that the state government plays in remaking our cities. The state has announced that it's ending talks in a $500 million train project in Stamford. This is from The Current. The announcement follows by a month the arrest in a New York bribery investigation of a New York construction executive who until recently was a key member of the team chosen by the state to transform the Stamford train station with hundreds of thousands of square feet of office, residential, retail, hotel, and parking space. Colin, so the state just sort of backs away from this thing we've been hearing for a very long time, in part because of the people who are behind making the thing happen.
Well, you're saying that, John. I don't think they've actually said that.
I don't think they've actually said that. Yeah. I think it might be fair to infer that.
Well, to use an overworked phrase these days, this is why we can't have nice things. Stamford does need a transit hub. You know, they need something that's, you know, more intermodal and stuff like that. I don't think they're going to get it, and it looks like they're going to have to build some garage locally or something, I mean, with local money and stuff. And, you know, I think Paz probably has a better handle on actually what went down here. But it goes back to the stuff that we were talking about in the previous segment, which is if you can give $10,000 to the state central committee and then give $10,000 more on behalf of your wife and $10,000 more on behalf of your golden retriever, and like pretty soon it starts to add up to something. And that does seem – I mean, once again, you can't really connect these dots all the time. But, you know, one of the major developers of this – not the guy who got arrested in New York, but one of the other major developers, you know, put a lot of money into, I mean, through this kind of familial bundling and company bundling, put a lot of money into the state central committee. And, it, you know, you can't say it's pay for play, but boy, it quacks and swims like it.
I'll be only slightly less cynical than Colin on that. This was on the merits of what they were trying to do as a transit-oriented development. This was a very shaky kind of house of cards. And the federal investigation in New York was sort of that last breath of air that caused the thing to finally topple. They were trying to do something very complicated they hadn't done before. It was a public-private partnership. They didn't really have a template for it. And yes, they invited a lot of public suspicion about how the developers were picked because there was a lot of money that flowed in. Governor Malloy was the mayor of Stamford. Governor Malloy knew all the people who were trying to get a piece of this. He told us not so long ago how he had stepped away. He had nothing to do with negotiating it. People at the DOT said, yeah, that was kind of true, which led Commissioner Redeker to also kind of keep a healthy distance. So it was a very complicated thing. They couldn't quite pull it off. It didn't help that there was this sort of aroma around it about the big money. So now they got to figure out how to replace an aging parking garage that's literally falling apart. They don't have the full budget for it because there was going to be a private piece that was going to help. So the bottom line is they're going back to the drawing board on a very key piece of transportation infrastructure. And yes, there's going to be a bit of a cynical hangover about to what extent money and political contributions played a role in keeping this thing on life support when they were unable to close the deal for literally a couple of years.
And it really is a terrible shame that it can't get done. Transit-oriented development, when it's actually done well, is a great boon, and it can actually go very well. But this, the state in general has not handled transit-oriented development kinds of stuff very well. I know commuters were pretty worried about this because of the secrecy surrounding it. And it just seems like the whole thing just rubs me the wrong way, and it rubbed them the wrong way. It's not surprising that it did finally fall apart. But what's going to actually happen there, it really is a shame. It's like, oh, we're just going to build another garage. Okay, great. That doesn't help.
Well, I want to move on a little bit. You know, Governor Malloy, because of things like this, I mean, a lot of us think, oh, maybe he's got to be sick of this job. Dealing with the budget, 24% approval rating, everything else. Well, News 8 asked the governor Monday morning if Hillary Clinton were to win the White House in November, he had an opportunity to be part of her cabinet, something a lot of people have talked about. Would he leave Connecticut? And what he said was, I plan on serving out my terms here in the state of Connecticut, and I look forward to the challenges. I like my job. Should we take the governor at his word? I suppose we should, Paz, but we've certainly heard that he has an inside line to some position in the Clinton administration. Do we expect that Governor Malloy will still be in this job if indeed Hillary Clinton takes office in January?
Probably. I think the governor, people I've talked to around the governor said, you know, I mean, he certainly would have been open to a serious offer for certain jobs. There's a couple problems. One, the Clintons have no shortage of white male politicians, if that's what they're looking for a particular job. The other one is there is a federal investigation into fundraising in Connecticut. Until that's resolved, I don't know that they're going to want to really look there. The other thing I'll throw out is there are certain questions, you know, take with a grain of salt, whatever answer you get. You know, when you ask somebody, as I think Christine Stewart did, like the first year of the governor's term, are you considering a third term? Of course he didn't rule it out because nobody wants to declare themselves to be a lame duck in year one. And people generally, when they're asked about their willingness to leave early, they generally say no because they don't want people at the Capitol to be viewing them as somebody who's got one foot out the door.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going into the Clinton administration for the same reason he's not going to become an astronaut, because they don't want him. And Paz's second point, I think, is the most important one. I mean, the first thing that Hillary Clinton's going to have to do as president, assuming she is convince everybody that she's not as crooked as Donald Trump kept saying she was, which means staffing her administration as much as possible with exactly the kind of people she hasn't been hanging around with. You know, all the Douglas Bans and Huma Abedins and all these people who have been kind of triple and quadruple dipping into the public and private sector. And so Dan Malloy, I mean, the person who decided Dan Malloy wasn't going to join the Clinton administration was Deirdre Daly, the U.S. attorney here in Connecticut. There's a grand jury looking into this other elections enforcement case, and that's going to keep him out even if there were any other reason for him to go. Now, I'd love to know what Susan and Paz think about Jim Himes. Jim Himes, if the Republicans are still the minority party in the House, would be a pretty attractive guy for like a second or third tier.
You mean the Democrats' minority party?
Democrats are still the minority in the House. He'd be a pretty attractive guy in Treasury somewhere. I mean, not he wouldn't get the secretary's job, but, I wouldn't be surprised. And that could create a real mess, too. Boy, congressional replacement elections are a nuisance.
No, that would be pretty interesting if that happened. Of course, maybe at some point, I think it's entirely possible that after a little while, not right at the start, but maybe given a year or two after Hillary Clinton takes office, maybe then, I don't know, maybe they'll give him the job of ambassador to Kyrgyzstan or something like that and get him as far away as possible, because that sets up a really interesting situation. If Dan Malloy is still in office in 2018 when the Republicans are running against him, that's going to be a brutal election for Democrats. If you have Nancy Wyman as an incumbent, that really changes things.
Well,
I'm bracing myself for our 2020 war with Kyrgyzstan now.
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of things. It's going to be an open seat 2018. There's no way in hell Dan Malloy is running for a third term. The Himes thing, by the way, I have not directly spoken to Himes about it. But, Colin, I assume you've heard the same things I've heard, which is there are people who are absolutely certain that Himes will join a Clinton administration. In what function? Who knows? And you're right. That will open. I mean, special elections are always a lot of fun. You never know quite what's going to happen. And that would be, an interesting test for what's the bench in both parties down there.
When we talk about the election coming up in November, of course, a lot of the conversation has been about Donald Trump saying that these elections are rigged for one reason or another. Many people point to cases that they've seen happen around the country, Paz, of dead voters voting or people who shouldn't be on the rolls getting on the rolls. I mean, what do we really know about that here in Connecticut?
Well, my glib line is if the dead are going to vote in Connecticut, history says it will be by absentee ballot.
Fittingly.
And fittingly. Absolutely fittingly. There has never been a documented case in Connecticut of somebody being found to have voted in the name of a dead person. Before people start screaming at me the way they did after I wrote a story last week about the myths and realities of voter fraud, let us stipulate voter fraud does exist. It absolutely does exist. But what the record shows is that it tends to be absentee ballot fraud, not in-person voter impersonation, in part because the economy's a scale. It's much better to go into an apartment building and try to steal 20 votes there than to convince a bunch of people to actually show up at the polls and commit a felony. And the other point is, in a presidential race, I mean, there's no evidence you can systemically do it.
All these facts are very reassuring and wonderful, but no Trump voter is going to really believe them. This is the problem when we have political parties and candidates that buy into one conspiracy theory after another. And the Republican base is so susceptible to conspiracy theories at this point that if they start saying, oh, it was rigged, oh, the voter fraud, oh, the election was stolen away from us, you're going to have a lot of people who really, truly believe it. And no facts will convince them otherwise.
Right. And so there are already these things circulating around. I think it came up from Texas recently. There's a lot of people on social media talking about some voters who voted early and saw their votes being recorded as Democratic votes when they're supposed to be Republican votes. I mean, some of this is, I think 29 of the chief elections officers in the U.S. are Republicans. In other words, Secretary of State or whatever the equivalent is. And certainly there are many more Republican governors than there are Democratic governors. So the argument and all of this has to happen at the state level. There's no way to federally rig an election. So, right away, you've got some interesting conversations here. You're essentially accusing people of your own party of rigging the election against the party's nominee.
We just have a couple minutes left, and we usually like to ask our guests to bring something into the outer sphere, something that we haven't talked about in the week's news. Anything you want to bring us this week, Susan?
Well, let's talk about hockey. I love hockey.
Hockey,
right. Yeah. So up in Springfield, Massachusetts, there is a new hockey team. The old team left for the hockey mad place of Tucson, Arizona. And a new one was brought in. And it's actually really exciting. I've never seen this kind of level of support and excitement among people in where I come from, in Enfield and Springfield and all that, about hockey. I went to their first game. They sold out, which hasn't happened in over 10 years. So, hey, that's really great.
Hockey? Soon casinos, legal pot, everything's happening
in
Springfield.
It's going to be a real wild time.
It's all coming together. Paz, a quick thought?
I just want to be the first to reassure people. I know everybody's bummed out. The election is almost over. But I want to be the first to, you know, welcome the news that exactly 2 weeks from today, the 2018 race for governor begins.
Oh, great. We're very excited about that. Colin and I were very excited about hearing this skit on Saturday Night Live this weekend.
The sound of the broom hitting the ceiling below us means that the party has to stop. But, Doug, I have to say it has been a pleasure.
Well, you know, right back at you, my brother.
All right, well, let's take a look at our final Jeopardy category, Lives That Matter. Well, it was good while it lasted, Doug.
It's gotten a lot of attention, Colin. This Black Jeopardy skit with Tom Hanks, it hits so many of the things that we're struggling to talk about, and programs like this, so right on the money.
It's that rare bit of political satire, too, that is really, really funny and then kind of brilliant. So basically, you're hearing Tom Hanks. He's a contestant on this Black Jeopardy show, which is a running gag on Saturday Night Live. Invariably, the contestants are all black, and the categories are very sort of black tropes. This time, Hanks shows up, and he's a Trump guy. He's got the Make America Great red hat on and all this stuff. But it turns out that his somewhat paranoid, marginalized, and disenfranchised interpretation of reality is very similar to those of the black contestants. I mean, that's the brilliant thing that's in this sketch, that until you get to that last moment that we heard, they have similar complaints.
And as you don't hear him say, "Now I've got some thoughts about this," but they didn't exactly have time to hear which lives matter. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Mark Pasniokas from ctmir.org, Susan Bigelow from ctnewsjunkie.com. Now we're going to tell you how you can support all the stuff you hear on public radio here on WNPR. Thanks so much for joining us in the Wheelhouse.